This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. When we think of ancient Egypt, we think of her kings, her gods, goddesses. We may also recall photographs of the great temples, decorated with scenes of the king making offerings to the deities. But what do we know of ancient Egypt's commoners? What were their beliefs? Did they make offerings to the gods? Was there any kind of religious training for the common man? These questions are the focus for a lecture this evening at the Spurlock Museum on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. The speaker will be Egyptologist Dr. Emily Teeter. She will give the Alan C. Campbell Distinguished Speaker Talk in the Knight Auditorium at 7:30 p.m. The event is free and open to the public. The talk is in conjunction with the museum's exhibition, Ancient Egypt, The Origins. Dr. Teeter, who is Egyptologist and Research Associate at the Oriental Institute at the University of Chicago, is my guest in this portion of the program. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
So how do Egyptologists know about the religious beliefs of the common people of ancient Egypt?
Well, luckily, the Egyptians wrote almost everything down. Now, certainly when we're talking about the non-royal people, we don't have as many records, but we have a lot of letters from people to each other. We have archaeological material. So there's actually a lot of data that we have to reconstruct what people were thinking and doing.
So do we know how people felt about religion?
Well, by extension, I think from what we can tell about religion, was to the Egyptians, it was very, very comforting. On the daily basis sort of scale, it was really about problem solving. It wasn't about philosophy. It wasn't even about mythologies. It was really about problem solving. The gods were very benevolent. If you had a problem, you'd go to the god and he'd help you.
Okay, very good. So they didn't present problems, the gods, for the people. And would this be the same then for the kings?
Well, the king had a different relationship with the god because the king had to serve the god. The king, in theory, three times a day has to feed the god, clothe the god, take care of the god. But that wasn't the case with ordinary people. Their relationship with the god really was about help. For example, if somebody lost his sheep, he'd go to the god and say, "Who took my sheep? Help me find my sheep."
Yeah.
And the relationship between people and the gods is so astoundingly close. We even have letters, people chastising the gods, saying, "Come out of the temple. I can't come in the temple, but you can come out. I want to talk to you."
So it's very personal.
It's very, very personal. And these records are so very interesting because it does tell us about what people were concerned about. It was just all these little issues of daily life about who took this, who took that. Why do I not feel well? Is somebody bothering me from the beyond? It really restores a tremendous sense of humanity to these people who lived thousands and thousands of years ago. It makes them much less abstract.
And did they make offerings then in thanksgiving to the gods if the gods came through for them?
In some cases they did. In other cases it seems to have been just sort of thanks a lot. So there's a variety of different experiences. In some cases, people will present something to the god in anticipation of the god helping them. We don't have too much evidence. We have a few examples of people presenting something in thanksgiving after the fact. But it seemed to be that the people had such an expectation, a normal expectation that the gods would help them, that it wasn't a huge amount of gift-giving back and forth.
Mm. Were there formal prayers?
There were some formal prayers. Those seemed to be primarily in the elite realm, or again, the relationship of the king to the gods. What we know about the normal people, the ordinary people, was more just of a common dialogue with the gods. They would address them as people. You know, "Please, Amun, come help me." That sort of thing. There are hymns, there are some prayers, but again, once you leave the temple context, it is a much more informal sort of type of religion.
Did they have the same deities as their kings?
They did have the same deities, very much the same.
And was there a particular deity that you would pray to if you had a particular kind of problem?
Not really. And often people were very all-inclusive. They wanted to cover their bets.
Uh-huh.
And so we have letters that say, "I call upon Amun, Khonsu, Montu, Ta, and all the gods by whom I pass." And so they just lump all the gods together, hoping that one of them is going to be alert. In fact, we even have the equivalent of ancient cell phones to reach the gods. They're called stelae of the hearing ears. They're little pieces of stone that have images of the ears of the gods on them. And you could actually carry these around with you. If you had a problem, you just take it out of your pocket and say your prayer into the ears of the gods.
Hmm.
So this tremendous closeness between man and God in ancient Egypt is pretty astounding.
Yeah. They would say, come out of the temple. So they weren't allowed in the temple?
That's a very good question. In many books, you'll read that people were not allowed in the temple at all. And in fact, there are parts of the temple that commoners were allowed into. And we know about this because there are often pretty inconspicuous inscriptions on architraves or walls that say what the function of that part of the temple was. Now, only the highest priests were allowed into the back of the temple, which was really the bedroom of the god, because these temples were where the god lived. And so people were allowed into certain parts of the temple on certain occasions. But people didn't have to go in the temple to reach the god. There were many different mechanisms. For example, usually on the back of the temple, so you didn't have to go in, there is a special shrine, again, called a place of hearing petitions of the gods, where people would go and say their prayers. And some of these we can identify also because the reliefs, the carved decoration on the wall, will be surrounded by little holes. And these were emplacements for drapes or little wooden constructions, almost like confessional booths, where people would come, go around the back side of the temple, which was open to the public, and go to those particular reliefs that had been singled out as being particularly potent.
Where was the temple located in the community in terms of the city or the village?
Temples are usually located smack in the middle of a village. Yep. And although we tend to think of the temples being really restricted to the priests. For example, the Temple of Karnak in southern Egypt at Luxor, which is the biggest temple. Many people know about this temple. Within the precincts of that temple, there was actually housing for priests. And so I think coming from a Western perspective, we tend to think of these temples as being so holy, but holy in a way that is different for us than it was for the Egyptians. Because religion really entered into all aspects of their religion. So there were restrictions. Only certain people could go into the back of the temple, but there were many, many people milling around the temple.
Yeah. Well, it says a lot, doesn't it, that the temple is smack dab in the middle of things. It's central to life.
It is central to life. The house, the temples are called the domain or the house of the god. So again, we have this analogy with people's houses and God's houses. And again, what we look at with Egyptian religion is that there's not very much mystery about it, that the realm of the gods is explained in very human kind of terms. And the Egyptian gods are even shown with nipples and navels.
Yeah.
Who are even if they have a dog head.
Who are the priests?
Oh, the priests. This is another very interesting thing, because people tend to think of Egyptian priests from a later period, from the Greco-Roman period, like the 4th century B.C., when they were professional priests. But for most of the time of the pharaohs, like the time of Tutankhamun and Ramses and these guys, most of the priests were actually part-time priests. And so they would serve 3 months of a year, and then they'd rotate off duty and go back to their profession, whether it be an accountant or a carpenter or a painter. And this is another way that we can see people had access into the temples, because perhaps during those 3 months of the year when they were serving as priests, they would have much more access into the temple than they would have at the rest of the year. So this whole idea about people of the community did not know what was going on in those temples is not supportable, because people who were carpenters the other time of the year were priests that were going much further into the temple than non-priests.
Was there any special training for priests?
This is a big issue. We don't know really anything about the training of priests. There were many, many different classes of priests. The Egyptians were very bureaucratic, very, very bureaucratic, and this carries over not only from the administration to priesthood, so there are lots of different levels and classes of priests. What we know from most of them is many of them were hereditary, so you learn your duties apparently as an apprentice from your father. There are women priests, priestesses, by the way, also, but we know almost nothing about formal training of priests, which is very odd.
Yeah. I wonder, too, if once you return to your profession outside, or your craft, your trade, your business, whatever it was, if you served as a sort of a missionary to people in the community?
I don't think so, because most, for example, most middle class, the equivalent of middle class males, would be in the same cycle, where they too would be priests for three months of the year. And so I don't think a missionary sort of thing is within the character of the ancient Egyptians. It just doesn't seem to fit.
Yeah. So they wouldn't be ministering to their neighbors,
no,
so to speak.
Well, because people minister to themselves, because they can have direct contact
right.
with the god. They don't need...
They have God's ear.
Exactly. And so I think a thing that's astounding about this recent research is probably a lot of people never went to the temples. We tend to assume the temples, because of their size, their magnificence, and all the economic documents about them, were the center of religion in ancient Egypt, when in fact they were the center of religion for a small percentage of the population. And the greater percentage of the population may have never gone there. They had household deities. They had cults they celebrated in their homes. There were elaborate festivals. We have these wonderful records of festivals, of statues of the gods being paraded through the necropolis. There was a major festival every 10 days in Thebes with statues of the gods leaving the temples where anybody in the village could see them. And so there was a tremendous amount of religion that went on outside the temple.
Very interesting. I'll be there tonight. Dr. Emily Teeter has been my guest in this portion of the program. Popular Religion in Ancient Egypt is the title of tonight's illustrated lecture, part of the Alan C. Campbell Speaker Series at the Spurlock Museum. The event is open to the public. The speaker, Egyptologist Dr. Emily Teeter. She will speak at 7:30 this evening in the Knight Auditorium. The Spurlock Museum is located on the U of I campus at 600 South Gregory Street in Urbana.